Morning. I'd like to begin with a reading from Daniel chapter 4. Daniel chapter 4 is an address from King Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon. And he's letting the entire world know about an experience that he had. And it begins with a dream. And of course, as with his previous dream, Daniel is the one who is asked to interpret this dream. And so in this dream, Nebuchadnezzar is a tree. And we're told that this tree became greater than all the other trees and that all flesh was fed from this tree. And what that does is it gives us an indication of what God expected of kings. And you've probably noticed this before throughout the Bible. If leaders of people are compared to shepherds, people are compared to sheep, and God always places the greater weight of responsibility on the shepherds. And that's consistent in the Old Testament and the New Testament. To whom much is given, much is required. James wrote, "Let not many of us be teachers, knowing that we shall receive the stricter condemnation." So, to whom much is given, much is required. We know that God set up the nations. He divided them up at Babel, and he appoints the authorities as they are, according to Romans chapter 13. So he has expectations for the nations and their leaders. And we see in this vision of the tree that one of those purposes is to provide some benefit to the people that God has placed this leader over. And this is true in the church as well. The elders of a congregation are supposed to provide a benefit or benefits to the flock. So this is the dream that Nebuchadnezzar has. And he's given a warning of what's about to take place, according to the decision of the watchers in verse 17. Verse 13. "I saw the visions of my head while on my bed, and there was a watcher, a holy one coming down from heaven. He cried aloud and said thus, 'Chop down the tree and cut off its branches, strip off its leaves and scatter its fruit. Let the beast get out from under it and the birds from its branches,' and promises to leave a stump." So in verse 19, when Daniel hears this dream and is giving its interpretation, he says, "Then Daniel, whose name was Belteshazzar, was astonished for a time, and his thoughts troubled him. So the king spoke and said, 'Belteshazzar, do not let the dream or its interpretation trouble you.' Belteshazzar answered and said, 'My lord, may the dream concern those who hate you, and its interpretation concern your enemies.'" And he goes on to explain the dream. And in verse 26, he says, "And inasmuch as they gave the command to leave the stump and roots of the tree, your kingdom shall be assured to you after you come to know that heaven rules. Therefore, O king, let my advice be acceptable to you. Break off your sins by being righteous and your iniquities by showing mercy to the poor. Perhaps there may be a lengthening of your prosperity." So then it continues, "All this came upon King Nebuchadnezzar at the end of the 12 months. He was walking about the royal palace of Babylon. The king spoke, saying, 'Is not this great Babylon that I have built for a royal dwelling by my mighty power and for the honor of my majesty?' While the word was still in the king's mouth, a voice fell from heaven, 'King Nebuchadnezzar, to you it is spoken, the kingdom has departed from you, and they shall drive you from men, and your dwelling shall be with the beasts of the field. They shall make you eat grass like oxen, and seven times shall pass over you until you know that the Most High rules in the kingdom of men, and gives it to whomever he chooses." Now, Daniel's name has the two elements in Hebrew of Dan, meaning judge, and El, meaning God. And so if you were to phrase it, it could mean God is my judge or God is the judge, something along those lines. And we remember all the way back at Abraham when he was receiving a visitation from the angel of the Lord, he addressed the angel as the judge of all the earth. So this is something that God has reserved for himself from the time that he separated the nations into their current places and boundaries. In Daniel chapter 2, it says that God appoints the nations to their times and seasons. And that's identical to what Paul was addressing in Acts 17 when he said he makes their times and boundaries. He decides how long a nation's going to last, what purpose it's going to serve, who is going to rule it, and if that nation transgresses to a point where God removes that nation, it's solely in his domain as the sovereign of all, as the judge of all the earth. Until that time, we recall what Paul said, that in every great house there are vessels, both of honor and dishonor, and God is always going to use the right instrument for the job. Some jobs that God requires as a judge of all the earth and its nations and peoples are unpleasant, and they're not things that he wants the church to do today. He has beaten the church's swords into plowshares, and he's handed all of that responsibility to the nations. And so if God is going to use a nation to punish another nation, he's got plenty of swords at his disposal. He doesn't need Christian swords to do that anymore. So the ideal of a nation has not changed. There is no plan of salvation for nations. There's a plan of salvation for you and I, but the nations serve a purpose only in this world, and there's going to come a day when he puts an end to all rule, power, and authority. And the nations will melt away, and every individual from those nations will be judged according to their works. One of the nations of this time period in the book of Daniel that God had made use of were the Assyrians. For a long time. In Isaiah chapter 10, God called them his sturdy warriors. And if you know anything about Mesopotamian history, you know that the Assyrian kingdom and people were the Romans of their day, or the Americans of their day. They were the top military over a period of about 1,500 years. And even though during that 1,500 years, their strength waxed and waned a little. It was really just a little. But they were the true mainstays in the power of Mesopotamia. And God used them to punish the Babylonians, to punish the Elamites, to punish Israel and Judah. Well, eventually, Assyria sinned. And so God did the just thing, which I think God always does. He raised up a prophet Jonah. We all know that story. Jonah eventually went to Assyria and preached, and it worked for a time. Then about 100 years later, a prophet named Nahum came along, and he wrote an entire letter, also addressed to the Assyrians. I don't know if he delivered himself or sent it by a messenger, but it would not make sense for God to write a message to Assyria and not get it to him. And apparently, it didn't work this time. And Assyria transgressed to a point where God decided it was time to remove Assyria. So God raised up the Chaldeans who took over Babylon. And he raised up the Medes and the Persians and the Scythians and a lot of other people. And it took all those nations' combined strength to take down the Assyrian kingdom. A nation that God had allowed to exist for a millennia and a half and had used as an instrument, as a rod of iron in Isaiah chapter 10, as it said. It got to a point where that nation was of no use, no further use to God. It had progressed in its transgressions to a point where it stank. And that's kind of the way God uses the language in the Old Testament to describe nations and their sins as abominations. Their idolatries got to a certain point. Their national sins and national character had degraded to such a point that God chose to remove that nation. And we see that very early. I mentioned Abraham not too long ago. Abraham was shown the entire land of Canaan and he walked it. But it wasn't being given to him yet because God said the iniquity of the Amorites was not yet fulfilled. So at a time of God's choosing, God can, you know, handle a lot of different things at the same time. God, 430 years later, had the Israelites actually come in and possess that kingdom because at that point, the iniquity of the Amorites had been full. In the book of Revelation, we have something called the cup of wrath. In the seventh bowl, it says that he gave her, speaking of the great city Babylon, says he gave her the cup to drink of the cup of the wine of the fierceness of his wrath. And I kind of, when I think of all the nations, I kind of think of it in those terms. When God makes a nation, he assigns it a cup. And as that nation progresses in its transgressions and sins, God takes a grape from the vine and squeezes that grape into this cup. And it represents its iniquity. And when that cup is full, when it's starting to overflow with iniquity, that's when God makes it drink of the wine of the cup of the fierceness of his wrath. And that's when he judges that nation. And oftentimes that's the end of that nation. Well, he does that with kingdoms, and he also does that with individual leaders, as we see here. He has told Nebuchadnezzar right in this passage that the kingdom has departed from you. And this was a judgment we see that takes place in heaven. It was heaven that made this decision, and it was announced by these watchers. Who else was told that the kingdom had departed from them? Saul. Saul was told that the kingdom had departed from him before David was even chosen and anointed. So Saul, we know his history of not doing things quite right, not doing things quite well with regarding the Amalekites and whatnot. He was told his kingdom would depart. Immediately, a distressing spirit comes upon Saul. So we see his fortunes immediately begin to fall. But what happens? God sends Samuel to go find a new replacement. And Saul was told that it has been given to another. So these decisions take time because obviously Saul continued to reign. And David slowly built up his kingdom. But the decision had already been made based on Saul's iniquity. So we have to assume here that it was, or not assume, we can see in Daniel chapter 4 by Nebuchadnezzar's own mouth that he had sinned in some egregious way. And what was it? Well, verse 30, to return there, is not this great Babylon that I have built for a royal dwelling by my mighty power and for the honor of my majesty? And what had he been told? Verse 26. And inasmuch as they gave the command to leave the stump and roots of the tree, your kingdom shall be assured to you after you come to know that heaven rules. Therefore, O king, let my advice be acceptable to you. Verse 25, sorry. They shall drive you from men. Your dwelling shall be with the beasts of the field, and they shall make you eat grass like oxen. They shall wet you with dew of heaven, and seven times shall pass over you till you know that the Most High rules in the kingdom of men and gives it to whomever he chooses. In verse 17, it said he gives it to the lowest of men. Well, if you compare Saul and David at that time period that we were mentioning earlier, Saul was at the height of his powers, a mature man who had been reigning for some time, a committed warrior, a very good warrior, and an experienced one. And what was David? David was a boy, a shepherd. And, you know, there are indications that Jesse was obviously a prominent man from Bethlehem. But if you were to compare David to Saul, there really isn't any comparison. God was choosing someone else who he told Saul was better than him. And here we have Nebuchadnezzar lifted up in pride, and to such a degree probably, that he's not recognizing who had given him this kingdom in the first place. But look at what Nebuchadnezzar is going to conclude. Verse 34 through the end of the chapter. At the end of the time, I, Nebuchadnezzar, lifted my eyes to heaven, and my understanding returned to me, and I blessed the Most High and praised and honored him who lives forever. For his dominion is an everlasting dominion, and his kingdom is from generation to generation. All the inhabitants of the earth are reputed as nothing. He does according to his will in the army of heaven. And among the inhabitants of the earth, no one can restrain his hand or say to him, "What have you done?" At the same time, my reason returned to me, And for the glory of my kingdom, my honor and splendor returned to me. My counselors and nobles resorted to me. I was restored in my kingdom, and excellent majesty was added to me. Now I, Nebuchadnezzar, praise and extol and honor the King of heaven, all of whose works are truth, and his ways justice, and those who walk in pride, he is able to put down. So Nebuchadnezzar and the Babylonians were instruments of God. And look at all the nations that God used them to punish, beginning with the Assyrians. But that's not even close to where it ended. He also used them to punish the Elamites. He also used them to punish Hamath and Egypt. And as we know very well, the city of Tyre. And the city of Tyre is talked about in the book of Ezekiel, and we can see there that it had amassed this vast wealth from a Mediterranean naval and merchant empire. It was kind of an ancient version of mercantilism. And from this, they had gained great, great wealth. And Nebuchadnezzar set his armies to conquer it. And it a siege that lasted 13 years and took a lot of great expense. In the book of Jeremiah, we're told that God sent the Pharaoh to Tyre while it was being besieged. And the purpose of the Egyptians was to break the siege. They were kind of allies of Tyre against Babylon. But God had the Egyptians go up there and lose to the Babylonians, and they were plundered. And in Jeremiah, God called that Nebuchadnezzar's wages. And the purpose of the wages was so that the Babylonians could continue the siege. Finally, after 13 years, the siege is successful. Tyre isn't destroyed, but it is reduced and pays tribute. And that massive mercantile empire becomes Nebuchadnezzar's. So Tyre had to submit. And in Ezekiel 28, we see the sins that it had committed. And they're a lot of the same things. Pride, arrogance. Those are the main things that occur to me anyway when we talk about the nations and kings and what they get punished for. So during this entire time of Nebuchadnezzar's reign, which began in 605 B.C., he was God's instrument, and he's called that several times in the book of Jeremiah even. He is God's instrument, he's God's vessel, and eventually he, of course, is used to punish Judah and Jerusalem itself. The irony of all this is that when the iniquity of the Amorites were fulfilled, God used his nation to punish the Canaanites and the Amorites. And my understanding of the Old Testament of this, if God had his preference, he would have always used his nation to punish the iniquities of other people. But because his people were backsliding constantly and going into following the idols of the nations and their false gods and perverting justice in their own land and oppressing the poor, God had to use pagan nations to punish his people. And it eventually became an abomination to God as well. So God has rules for kings, and he has rules for kingdoms, and they're actually quite simple. In my understanding of the Old Testament, what God expects of kings and kingdoms, we see elements of them all here. They're supposed to provide benefit to the people that they rule. They're supposed to deliver justice. They're supposed to deliver the oppressed and the poor. They're supposed to protect the boundaries and borders of their kingdom. These things are simply done, or in concept, these things are all simple, but in the execution of them, we constantly see the same things get in the way. Nebuchadnezzar, we know from history and the Bible, literally sucked up all the wealth of the ancient world, of what we call the ancient Near East and Middle East. He impoverished entire regions and left them starving so that he could build Babylon the Great. And the testimony of all historians, especially the Greeks centuries later, all testified to how amazing Babylon was. They'd never seen anything like it. It was a city that 4 14 chariots could race along its walls. Nothing had ever been built like Babylon, and Nebuchadnezzar testifies to it here. But at what cost? But at what cost? Well, the human cost was great. He left entire cities and regions starving, literally, so that he could use their wealth to build this great city. And God looks at that, and he looks at the pride that engendered in Nebuchadnezzar. And eventually, because Nebuchadnezzar had already fulfilled his purpose in regards to punishing the other nations, God only has one last chore for Nebuchadnezzar. He only has one more use for him, and that is to bring him down and use him as an example. And Nebuchadnezzar was an amazing individual. I've read enough about him and another great men throughout history that the only reason he's not referred to as Nebuchadnezzar the Great is because his kingdom didn't long survive him. It only lasted another 20 years or so after he died. Otherwise, he's just like all the other greats of all time who conquered this and built that. And in spite of all that greatness, the best thing that ever happened to Nebuchadnezzar was what happened to him here in Daniel chapter 4. I have no hope for the Babylonians as a people or their city. But because of what we read here, and just think about this for a moment, because of what we read here in Daniel chapter 4, I do have hope for Nebuchadnezzar the individual. Because what has God always required of men and women but to acknowledge him as their creator and as their provider, and to proclaim his praises far and wide? Well, in his day, Nebuchadnezzar had no greater celebrity status. No one had any greater celebrity status than Nebuchadnezzar. Nobody had a brighter, higher podium to speak from than Nebuchadnezzar. And I think that this message that he posted probably throughout his empire, he was well placed. Everybody could see him, and everybody could see God bring him down. Now, when he came back, he could have said this or that, but what he does is he tells everybody the truth. And that is that God reigns in the kingdom of men, that he is full of truth and justice, and all his works are truth, and his ways are justice. And those who walk in pride, he is able to put down. The greatest testimony of Nebuchadnezzar was not a city. It was this right here, when he let all the people of his kingdom know who reigns in the kingdom of men. And he is the King of heaven. That's our lesson for this morning. David was not a perfect man. But God did tell Saul that David is better than you. Samuel told Saul, he has taken your kingdom and given it to your neighbor who is better than you. But David wasn't perfect. David was a murderer and an adulterer. But David gives me hope. Because we can commit adultery and murder in our hearts. And we can do so pretty easily. But Nebuchadnezzar also gives me hope. Because if we can acknowledge God on a daily basis and proclaim him, what is Jesus promise to do if you testify of him before men? I will testify of you before my Father. And I think Nebuchadnezzar testified to men on behalf of God. So does that mean that maybe there is some hope that Nebuchadnezzar's name is also written? I don't know. But the goal here in this life is to make sure that your name is written in heaven, just as it's mentioned here in Daniel chapter 4. This congregation would like to extend an invitation to you. If there's anything that you would like to bring before the congregation, or if you would like to devote yourself to Jesus Christ, we invite you to do so as we stand and as we sing.